Judiciary Committee is called to order. Today is Wednesday, February 7th, 2024, and the time is 1:12 p.m. We are meeting in the Max Grimberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. I ask that you please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Shelby with the Juneau LAO and Sophia with House Records. The following members present is Representative Johnson, Representative Gray, Representative Carpenter, Representative Groh, Representative Sumner, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. We have a full committee to do business today. On today's agenda, we have three items: to bring back House Bill 97, Self-Storage Units, Liens, and Sales by Representative Prox, and House Bill 67, Harassment, Sex Offenders, and Offenses by the Governor, and a quick introduction of House Bill 161, Civil Legal Services Fund by Representative Wright. First item on our agenda, we will bring back House Bill 97, Self-Storage Units. In its second hearing, we will take public testimony, consider two amendments, and look to the committee's will on final action of the bill. So I would now like to open public testimony on CSHB 97. Is there anyone in the room who is would like to testify on House Bill 97? As Gary Jenkins in the room? Please come to the table. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you will have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson, members of the committee. My name is Gary Jenkins. I live in Juneau, and I own one self-storage complex and manage four others. With regard to HB 97, this bill, if it's adopted as it's written, would not have any effect on me whatsoever. I consider myself a responsible operator, and I would continue to operate in the same way. And I assume the committee has been briefed, and you're aware that most operators in Alaska are operating currently under the warehouseman statutes, which I think go all the way back to statehood. And they're pretty brief, but they set a framework. But so from my perspective, this would not have any effect on what I do today. But what I think the committee really needs to be aware of is this language in this bill will set some extremely bad precedents that I really don't think you want to go home and tell your constituents about. And I call your attention specifically to, on the second page, I'm working off of the CS that came out of Labor and Commerce. And I didn't think you had adopted anything at this point in time. And I apologize for not being here Monday. The bill tracking system told me you were not going to take this bill up until Friday. So I was all prepared to come on Friday until I talked to one of your staff. Anyway, I am interpreting this bill literally as it's written. I call your attention to section 3435.620, which talks about what can happen after default. And I'm literally interpreting default, if I define it in the narrowest sense, if I set up a contract with you and your rent is due yesterday and you didn't pay it, today you are in default. So that's the premise under which I'm operating, and a rental agreement can be written that way, even under this statute. This provision does what it does is it enables and encourages extremely bad behavior on the part of operators. I call your attention to paragraph 2, which says, as an owner, if a person is in default, if you didn't pay me yesterday and you owed me X dollars, whatever it is, I can move the things that you have stored to anywhere I want to. If I have a renter for your size unit and I have a big one open, I could just move your stuff. And I think that's basically, to my look at it, it's unconscionable. An operator should not have that ability. And and it could be commingled with other people's stuff. There's no language about any control whatsoever. It could be commingled with other people's stuff. And if the person, the renter, pays, then they have to go see if they can find all the stuff that they had in storage if they remember what they had in storage. The most egregious is subparagraph 3, which talks about if you stored a vehicle, which vehicle has extremely broad definition in the statute, which would mean anything from a car, an RV, your favorite ATV that you take moose hunting, or even your child's favorite bicycle, would all be fall under the definition of vehicle. And what this says right now under this version is that if I feel like it, I can just take your vehicle or your motorhome or your watercraft, this also includes boats, and hook onto it, tow it out of my storage yard, leave it on the street, and I have no responsibility whatsoever. The third subparagraph,
Mr. Jenkins.
C says that, says that a facility owner may not be held liable for damage incurred to a unit, a renter's vehicle or watercraft, if it's removed from my storage facility. And so it's just goes against my very nature to even see that kind of language in a bill because of what it encourages and enables. The other thing, a much more minor deal is
Mr.
that,
Jenkins, could you wrap up your testimony?
Okay.
It would be much more than your 2 minutes.
Okay. I'm sorry. It just, there's a lot of structural errors in the bill that I think ought to be clarified before it moves forward. Would highly recommend that. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to move online. First up, we have Nathaniel Dye from the Juneau Self-Storage Unit. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Nathaniel Dye. I'm with Juneau Self-Storage in Juneau and American Mini Storage in Palmer. Thank you, Chair, for the time today to speak. We've been working on this from my point of view, from Juneau Self-Storage point of view, with owners, our ownership, for the better part of 4 or 5 years trying to get a minimum requirement statute in place. And I think this does this very fairly and does the best to protect consumers and the business owners involved. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Daniel Bryant from the Self-Storage Association. I apologize. He's available for questions. We have William Brewer from the Fairbanks Storage. Please state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Vance and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, I am William Brewer, the owner of Fairbanks Storage in Fairbanks. As a small self-storage business owner, it is scary to operate my business in Alaska with no governed framework or set of laws to follow when the customer is paying me to protect and store their personal items. HB 97 is asking for a set of laws so that all self-storage business owners are operating on the same terms and fairness for both owners and tenants. Being in the self-storage business for the past 5 years, I have seen firsthand that the majority of business transactions are perfect and no issues arise. But 1 or 2% of the time, a customer will stop paying, either abandons their stuff or cannot be contacted, and that is when this bill is most needed. I can assure you that storage owners do not want this bill to pass in order to have legal authority to take possession of customer stuff, but instead we're just asking for a set of rules so that we can turn over the unit to a new paying customer and stop the loss of revenue for those customers who do not abide by the rental agreement. I must stress that we're not talking about disposing of luxury cars, Picasso paintings, and priceless artifacts, but instead almost 99% of the time we are left with a unit filled with mostly trash, used box springs, empty cardboard boxes, and other invaluable items left behind. During Monday's committee hearing, Representative Johnson was concerned about the use of email when notifying the delinquent customer. Representative Johnson, I can assure you that I've had the best result in reaching the tenant by email than any certified mailing. The majority of storage tenants are in transit, and the only thing that transfers with the person is an email address. Almost 90% of all certified mailings come back to my business undeliverable because either the tenant is no longer at the given address, or more likely, they do not want to sign for it because honestly, what good news has ever delivered certified mail? Other concerns from the past meeting that I heard were whether 30-day notice was adequate, and if 2 notices are enough for a tenant that could possibly be out of town. HB 97 storage lien laws are no different than the Alaska Landlord-Tenant Act regarding non-paying tenants or individuals who stop paying their car, phone, or house payments. I ask you all, why should self-storage business owners in Alaska not be allowed to dispose of a tenant's belongings who did not fulfill their terms of the rental agreement? If a residential apartment tenant stops paying rent, the landlord gives them a 7-day notice to quit, which gives them 1 week to either pay or move out. I feel that 30 days and 2 notices is more than adequate for items left in a storage unit. Lastly, in Monday's committee hearing, Representative...
Testimony. Next up, we have Elizabeth Mann with Alaska Mini Storage. Please state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you. For the record, this is Elizabeth Mann. I'm the general manager for all four Alaska Mini Storage facilities. Myself and the owners are in favor of HB 97. We do not feel that HB 97 is challenging any of our existing policies or regulations. In summary, without a lien law, storage in Alaska is subject to a wild, wild west environment in our experience. HB 97 will hold storage facilities to a higher standard, in turn gaining us more respect from our communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Tyler Scott from Public Self Storage. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Hello. My name is Tyler Scott from Public Self Storage in Anchorage. We operate 7 storage facilities in and around Anchorage and Eagle River. We're in support of this bill to sort of mirror what other people said on two fronts. It really protects a customer because it defines what is allowed by storage operators, as well as it brings more of an even playing field to the storage operators because it defines what we are doing. We are currently one of the, I think maybe the only state without some type of legislation like this. And it makes sense from a consumer standpoint as well as an operator standpoint. That's all.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Lonnie Bickford. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, hi, my name is Lonnie Bickford, living with Scylla, Alaska, on AK Storage Center, and own storage facilities in Louisiana and have in the past in Texas. Also own a company called StorageAuctions.com, which is based in Alaska. But we hold online auctions in all 50 states. Along with that, we provide services of reviewing the notifications and the different steps that each state requires for a storage owner to be able to have the sale. For anybody concerned about what's being sold in these units, I think I have about 5,000 on my website right now. You're welcome to go in there and look. There's no Picassos. It's just left behind stuff normally. Every now and then you get good stuff. But this bill would protect us from doing the right thing. Alaska is the only state that doesn't define as storage owners some of these things that we're asking for in this bill. I've testified in many states as a kind of expert on the auction side. This is just solid law that's in most every state right now. This language is pretty much the same as in most states. So in favor of the bill, you can check out the website to see the kind of stuff left behind. And it will allow storage owners a kind of a uniform way to act. And as far as the vehicles and boats left behind, I bought a store in Wasilla. I have 14 boats and vehicles that were left behind without leases. Anybody that wants one of them for $100, they're welcome to come get them. They're junk. And I don't have a way that I can sell this thing per the law. And no one even wants to tow them. So we're trying to kind of make things make sense here. And I'm in favor of the bill. So thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Let me double check. Seeing no further public testimony online, I am now going to close public testimony on House Bill 97. For those watching online who did not have an opportunity to testify, you can email your written testimony to house.judiciary@akleg.gov, and it will be uploaded to the record. Committee substitute for House Bill 97 is before us, and we have 2 amendments at the request of the bill sponsor for the committee's consideration. Vice Chair Allard, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number 1, S.6, please.
And I object for purposes of discussion. Representative Prox, if you would care to walk us through amendment number 1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is, for the record, Mike Prox, District 33. And correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm the requester of the amendment, but I just haven't been thinking about this morning. What amendment number one attempts to accomplish is that to make the facility owner's lien subordinate to any other liens that might be on the property in question. And we talked to the facility owner's representative, if you will, and they seem to be in agreement with that, but it would be a good idea, because he's online, to ask him the question.
Let's see, is that
Mr. Bryant?
Daniel Bryant.
Yes.
He is not online.
He is not.
Mr. Bryant, if you could return to us, it would be greatly appreciated. But in the meantime, do we have any questions from committee members? Oh, now I see that Mr. Bryant is on. Do you want to ask a question first, Representative Sumner?
Madam Chair, and through the chair, I guess I would ask why the default notice in section 3435.625 is insufficient, since it does require the noticing of the lien holders. And then furthermore, I might point out that some vehicles with the lien, you know, you drive the new car off the lot and you're underwater maybe already, or at some point in your payments. So there, you may be setting a situation in which storage owners are not able to be reimbursed at all for the storing of the vehicle. So how would you address that?
It's a valid point. And actually, I would like to defer to Mr. Bryant on that.
Mr. Bryant, did you hear the question from Representative Sumner?
Yeah, I did. And through the chair, thank you, Representative Sumner, for the question. I certainly understand the concern. I agree with it. It's certainly valid. Our, I guess, overarching concern was just trying to reach, you know, some bit of compromise with folks from the financial institutions in the state, and trying to, you know, put them in a spot where they were comfortable with the text of legislation. I think there was some concern that perhaps vehicles might sit at a storage facility for perhaps longer than they felt was appropriate, and racking up additional fees and charges. That's not something that occurs that I'm aware of. But again, really what was looking to do here was just trying to, you know, find some common ground with the financial institutions in the state on an amendment that kind of works for everybody, in the hopes of continuing to keep this legislation moving.
Follow up.
Follow-up through the chair, I guess this would be to Representative Prox. I'm unfamiliar with the situation, but what would be the case if a vehicle with a lien on it is simply towed to a tow yard? Would they be subordinate to the lien?
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Sumner. That is in a different part of the statute, and I believe the answer is no. That the towing company's storage lien, I guess, would be superior to the lien holder, the bank, if you will, the lender. And I believe the same would apply for a mechanic's lien. So this, the facility owners are more easygoing than the towing companies, yes.
Follow-up, Representative Sumner.
Follow-up through the chair. So, Representative Prox, I guess I would ask why we have a more strict treatment for a situation that people are essentially always voluntarily entering into versus one where the towing situation may be involuntary, but they have an easier treatment on the lien preference.
It's a good point. Yes, I had thought about that previously, and it could be argued to be consistent with other statutes that just notification is sufficient, or we might want to think about readdressing those other statutes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yeah, so I think germane to Representative Sumner's point or question, line of questioning here, the owner of the vehicle, if the vehicle has a lien on it, is not actually the person who took out the storage facility. It's actually the bank, so or the lien holder. So if the person that took out the storage unit and placed their piece of equipment in there, and then they stopped making payments on the storage unit, and they stopped making payments on the piece of equipment, then it reverts back to the bank as the owner. And the bank, through that process of signing a contract with the owner of the, or the lessee of the vehicle, that's at their risk. They've got a piece of property that they're now going to have to reclaim. And it seems to me that they would then, as a matter of doing business, have to reclaim this from the storage unit. As that's just the risk that they take in putting a loan out for a vehicle. And so they can reclaim their property because they're going to need to do something with it. And so I don't see the need for the amendment. That's what I'm saying.
Any further questions or comments? Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Chair. Representative Prox, I still have contention a little bit with the email being one of the only ways to notify the consumer, the renter of the facility. And the reason why is because a lot of times we could see spam email. I mean, I've had people say, I emailed you and I lose it. Would you be open to working that to where it's either both certified and email, but not just email as a notification as the presenter of this bill or the sponsor of this bill? I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Right. And thank you, through the chair, to Representative Allard. I get your point, but actually, no. The facility owner still accrues expenses, or expenses through loss of income, and it is up to the renter to be responsible.
Vice Chair Allard, is this question pertinent to amendment number one?
Oh, good point.
Yep, my point of order would be that I don't believe the question is germane to the amendment before us. Yeah. Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thinking, I apologize. Scratch that.
Yep. Strike that from the record.
Okay, we have before us amendment number one for consideration by the committee, and this was to raise the question about priorities with the lien. If it is the will of the committee to continue with the bill as written, I can easily withdraw the amendment, streamline this process. So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know what this does. I think I got it 11:30 today. I haven't had a chance to really look at it. I haven't had a chance to review it. We were both in meetings up until 5 minutes before this meeting. I was up in a meeting when this was delivered to my office. The first I actually had a chance to set my eyes on it was right now. So it's more of a process than the amendment. So I don't have a problem with the underlying bill, but I do have a problem with rushing amendments through without proper vetting. And I know sometimes it happens. They happen on the fly. I'm just not comfortable voting on an amendment that I haven't. I've had since this 15 minutes to look at it. So I would encourage you to set this aside.
Can I entertain a motion to table amendment number one?
I would move to table amendment number one indefinitely.
Hearing no objection, amendment number one has been tabled.
Madam Chair.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Thank you.
back on the record. After deliberation about consideration of the amendments and further action on this bill, I want to make sure that committee members are comfortable with being able to review the material and answer any further questions. So I'm going to set House Bill 97 aside to be able to take up at a future date. Thank you, Representative Prox. Do you have any further further comments for the committee?
Yes. If you have questions about this, please give me a call, send me an email. After five is just fine because it's kind of a simple bill, but it deals in a section of law that we're generally unfamiliar with. So please give me a call.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. So we will now take up House Bill 67, harassment, sex offenders, and offenses by the governor and as presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in its fourth hearing. You know, a little bit easier, Bill. So we will continue the amendments for House Bill 67. At the last hearing, the committee adopted Amendment Number 1, sponsored by myself, and we will now start with Amendment Number 2. Do all of the committee members have the amendments for House Bill 67 before we continue? Jake is bringing those now.
Brief at ease.
Back on the record. My apologies. We are going to set House Bill 67 aside so that members can have time to review some of the very hefty amendments. I want to thank the Department of Law, Criminal Division for being available today. You may not want to run off because members might have questions for you sometime later today. We do have now in our hands all of the amendments, but just for everyone, the process that it takes to get the changes that we want and have time for members to review them is not sufficient right now in this crime bill. So we are going to set it aside and take it up at another time. We are now have a first introduction of House Bill 61, Civil Legal Services Fund, by Representative Wright in his first hearing. I'd like to welcome to the table Representative Wright and his staff. If you could both please join us at the table, place your names on the record, and begin walking us through your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Stanley Wright, and I'm joined with my staff, Ms. Rachel Gunn. This bill, aiming to enhance appropriations to the Civil Legal Service Fund, is a testament to our collective determination to restore the foundational promise of our legal system, accessible justice for all. The Alaska Legal Service Corporation serves as a beacon of hope, providing indispensable legal assistance to low-income Alaskans. This organization has proven its worth by delivering significant economic impacts and social benefits, offering a lifeline to thousands facing legal hurdles that threaten their homes, families, and very livelihoods. By increasing the fund's appropriation, we not only enable ALSC to extend its reach, but also amplify the economic benefits of our state. Every dollar invested generates a remarkable return, empowering our residents, stimulating local economies, and alleviating burdens on our courts. Increasing support to the ALSC aligns with the desire for direct citizen engagement and appeal in the legal process. By ensuring that individuals have the legal support necessary to navigate the judicial system. And with your permission, I'll now hand things over to my legislative staff, Ms. Rachel Gunn.
Thank you. Through the chair, on the record, my name is Rachel Gunn, staff to Representative Stanley Wright. I want to thank you today for hearing our bill. I want to start with this problem that we're facing. We have a growing gap between those who can afford legal help and those who cannot. Despite constitutional guarantees, many are left without necessary legal support due to insufficient funding. Alaska Legal Services Corp. aims to ensure fairness in the justice system for all, regardless of income or location. They provide individual legal advice, form drafting, community education, clinics, focusing on health, safety, and family needs. ALSC is the largest provider of legal services for victims of domestic violence, the men, women, and children affected, but also grandparents and caregivers. They serve our seniors, our veterans, disabled Alaskans, and advocate for our children. They prevent homelessness, stop domestic violence, ensure child support, help obtain lawful benefits, and help end financial abuse. ALSC, an organization with a proven track record of delivering a 5-to-1 return on investment to our state and local economies, demonstrates the undeniable value of legal services. 80% of cases that make it to the ALSC are mitigated before a court case or administrative hearing, saving our courts valuable time, energy, and costs. However, the efficacy of ALSC is hampered by funding challenges, with the organization forced to turn away over 50% of applicants who pre-qualify under the federal poverty guidelines due to resource limitations. The stark reality is that ALSC's funding has not kept pace with the growing need. In 1984, the state contributed $1.2 million towards Alaska Legal Services for a population of 40,000 citizens. As the population in need of legal services has surged threefold since then, the funding took a contrary trajectory, decreasing to $701,214 in the 2024 fiscal year. That amounts to just a little over $5 per person in need. Despite bipartisan support, the fluctuation in funding amount significantly impacts ALSC's ability to meet these growing needs. HB 161 is a valuable investment that translates into tangible benefits for our communities, enhancing well-being and reducing public costs associated with homelessness and domestic violence, while ensuring an equitable justice system for all. With that in mind, I do have the interim director of Alaska Legal Services, Maggie Hum, available for our invited testimony.
Is Maggie Hum available in the room?
Yes.
Please join us at the table. Welcome. Please state your name for the record, and you will have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Vance and the members of this committee, for considering HB 161 today. My name is Maggie Hum, and I am the interim executive director at Alaska Legal Services. I also want to thank Representative Wright for sponsoring this very important legislation. As was stated, ALSC is a nonprofit law firm. We provide comprehensive and free civil legal services to low-income Alaskans, and we've been doing that since we opened our doors nearly 60 years ago. Before I start telling you about the amazing work that we do and the challenges that we're facing, I just want to explain why it's important to adequately fund civil legal services. We know that in criminal cases, defendants are entitled to attorneys. That's not the case in civil matters. And while both our state and federal constitutions guarantee due process and equal protection under the law, when it comes to civil legal system, we are facing an enormous justice crisis because there is a very large gap between those who can actually identify and address their civil legal needs and those who can't. The best way to tell you about the work that HB 161 seeks to address is to give you examples of the type of work that we do. And I'm going to give you some anecdotes, and these names have been changed, of course, to protect confidentiality. Peter is a 90-year-old veteran who faced the loss of his home due to foreclosure by a big bank, which was legally defective. He had very limited income. An ALSC attorney successfully challenged the foreclosure in court and kept Peter and his wife in their home. Without our help in this extremely complex and protracted legal matter, this couple would have been evicted from their home within a short time of first coming to our office. Megan was just 18 years old and had an infant son when she came to ALSC for help. Her boyfriend and the father of her baby had been assaulting her since she was just 16 years old. On two occasions, just a few days apart, he assaulted her in the presence of their baby, causing injuries to her lip and other bruises. She obtained a short-term order on her own, and then she came to ALSC for help, getting the long-term protective order, an attorney successfully representing her doing that, getting the order, custody of her child, child support, and supervised visitation for the father. Andrew was a victim of sex trafficking as a young teenager. An ALSC attorney represented her in criminal proceedings. Victims are not entitled to attorneys in these proceedings. This entailed reading through thousands of pages of text messages and interviews, keeping out details prior to the trial that the defendant would use to try to discredit her, and protecting her at the trial as much as possible while she gave gut-wrenching testimony. The defendant was found guilty, and Angie has a chance for a fresh start. Every day at ALSC, we provide legal help for individuals and families like those I have just described so they can protect their livelihoods, their housing, health, safety, and their families. We have 12 offices around the state in Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, Kotzebue, Ketchikan, Nome, Bethel, Dillingham, Kenai, Palmer, Ukiavik, and Wasilla. Last year, we provided direct representation to nearly 5,000 families, with over impacting 13,000 individuals. We serve countless more through our other educational and outreach opportunities and our website. We have been the forefront of fighting domestic violence since we opened our doors. Last year, we served over 1,200 individuals impacted by domestic violence, and nearly 60% of those households had children. We served over 2,400 seniors, veterans, and disabled individuals. We helped over 800 veterans and disabled individuals gain access to health care coverage and benefits they earned and desperately needed. We serve folks in 196 communities. This work on behalf of vulnerable children and adults reduces future risk of injury, illness, and stabilizes homes and prevents homelessness and much more. We are good at what we do. A 2012 study by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority found that we are successful 86% of the time. Ms. Gunn went over some statistics that, in the interest of time, I will not be able to repeat, except I just want to emphasize there is a 5-to-1 return on investment for every dollar invested in Alaska Legal Services. We return that to the community in terms of direct economic benefits and in cost savings. There are also a number of types of cases that we do not do and we're prohibited from federal law by doing. Those include class actions, cases on welfare reform, cases about abortion, assisted suicide, redistricting. We are not allowed to represent undocumented immigrants except where DV or human trafficking is involved. And fee-generating cases that private lawyers will take on a contingency, we also are not allowed to take. Our work differs from the ACLU and the Northern Justice Project.
Please wrap up your testimony.
Yes, I will. As Ms. Gunn said, funding has not kept pace with the growth of the poverty population in Alaska. What we are asking in this bill is to have our percentage of the Civil Legal Services Fund increase from 10% to 25%. There is an extraordinary need for critical legal services, and we can't meet this alone. We have to bridge this gap and assure access to justice as a reality for all Alaskans, not just those who can afford an attorney. The most vulnerable Alaskans must receive the legal care they require to protect their most basic needs.
Thank you so much. Do we have any questions from committee members for Ms. Hum? Representative Groh.
Thank you, Chair Vance. First of all, thank you for presenting testimony today, and thanks to the sponsor for this bill, which I very much support. I wanted to ask a question, a couple questions. Does the Alaska Legal Services Corporation ever get court-ordered awards of punitive damages? Has that ever occurred?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, the punitive damages piece of the Civil Legal Services Fund it's my understanding that there have not been punitive damages awarded to the state that then come to us, that has typically not been a non-existent amount, as far as I understand, or a very small amount, because the punitive damages must go, are punitive damages awarded to the state, not to ALSC directly.
Follow-up?
Have there ever been any awarded as a result of Alaska Legal Services work to the state of punitive damages in cases that Alaska Legal Services has been involved in?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, Is the question, do we directly receive punitive damage awards?
Do the courts have ever ordered punitive damages in cases in which you represented the client?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, it is possible, yes, that we have gotten punitive damages. Typically, our cases do not involve punitive damages, but it's possible that they have.
Okay, so my only follow-up would be, I take it that it hasn't been that much money then?
That we directly receive in punitive
damages? Or that the state has received or some other entity?
Right, through the chair to Representative Groh. The punitive damages awards that are under the Civil Legal Services Fund awarded to ALSC, it is my understanding that those have essentially been non-existent as a source of funding.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. Can you tell me, you said 10% to 25%. Can you give me that in dollars?
Yes. So it does fluctuate through the chair to Representative Allard. It does fluctuate the amount that we are awarded because it depends on the number of court cases that are filed. And so in the most recent fiscal year, that was approximately $301,000. In the year prior, it was $281,000. And so an increase of to 25%, if you did it on this year's numbers, would be roughly $700,000.
Follow up. Thank you. Could you, and you probably said it and I didn't hear you, could you tell me how many cases you've done in the last, well, I'm kind of curious about the COVID thing. So COVID, I was told things kind of died down a little bit because people were kind of locked down, but then all of a sudden it exploded. Can you tell me maybe your last 3 years of history of how many each year and then the dollar value attached to that for me, please?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, this prior year we had 5,000 cases. I believe the year before that it was roughly 3,000. I do not have the year prior to that off the top of my head, but I could get that.
May I follow up? You already, and so you gave me, was it 281,000 for 5,000 cases? Or 281,000, is that right?
That would have, through the chair to Representative Allard, that would have been, yes, this current fiscal year is 301, and the year prior it was 218.
Okay.
Right. Or 281, sorry.
Representative Sumner.
Through the chair, I guess, could I ask what percentage of your cases are related to evictions?
Through the chair to Representative Sumner. I don't have the exact number of cases related to evictions. Housing cases are one of our top types of cases that we do.
Follow up?
Sorry, through the chair. So do you know approximately what percentage would be classified then as housing cases?
One number I have for you today, and sorry, I shortcut my testimony a little bit thinking I had more time, we have roughly last year, these stats that I provided to you regarding, I'm sorry, through the chair to Representative Sumner, regarding the number of seniors, veterans, disabled individuals we have served. We have helped last year, for that same time period, we helped roughly 700 folks with housing matters, I believe. So,
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. So you said 700 folks, and I've gotten a lot of concern on this bill from landlords. And I think the reason why is because thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the reason why is because what they're telling me is that they hire the services, but then they're still found that they're liable. And I'm wondering, and then the landlord is out substantial amount of funds. How do you guys weigh that?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I think if I...
I could elaborate a little bit.
Yeah, I think if you could clarify, that would be helpful. Yeah.
So you have a tenant, they're renting the house, they're not paying, they're living there for so many days, landlords can't evict them, they hire the legal services, and then what happens is ultimately they're found guilty anyways, the landlord's out 8-9 months of rent. How do you guys reconcile that with landlords that are struggling too? Is that, and if the person is, it's wrong, if they're wrong, can you help me with that?
Yeah, so through the chair to Representative Allard, a few comments about that. One, we are often able to negotiate with landlords shortly after they have filed an eviction or before the case gets to court. And that way, we are saving both the tenant and the landlord money and the time of having to go to court. If there is a legal defense, we will sometimes go all the way to court. There is a great deal of, so we do a great deal of negotiating between landlords and tenants that I think landlords will often appreciate because we are saving folks money and we are able to talk with the tenants we're working with about their legal options and whether they're viable legal options. I guess the other thing just to note too is that we have a landlord-tenant hotline 4 nights a week that's open to both landlord and tenants, and both landlord and tenants call that hotline. It's a very busy hotline 4 nights a week. So I'm not sure if I answered the question, but
follow up. Yeah.
So if a tenant is wrong and you ultimately find out you should have been paying your rent, the landlord's out 4, 5, 6, 7 months rent. How does that reconcile with the landlord as far as does the person who didn't pay him just walk away and the landlord's just out those funds because maybe using your services delay something that inevitably could have been solved quicker and they could have had someone else in the facility or the apartment
mm-hmm.
or housing? I'm just trying to figure out if everybody's being treated equally.
Right. Through the chair to Representative Allard, I think that, again, if we're able to help that landlord and tenant negotiate an earlier walk away in situations where a tenant can't pay, that ultimately does save the money and the tenant's able to find a different place to move to, perhaps, if it's just not a viable situation between the landlord and the tenant, right? Then the landlord, however, is always, they're free to sue, you know, still for damages, right? And they may have already opened an eviction case, and then they often will, if somebody is being evicted and it's, you know, not a case that the tenant can defend, the landlord will pursue those damages against the tenant to you know, recoup some of that money. And we often only participate, and due to our limited resources, we're only participating in that possession phase of the eviction. Not 100% of the time, but most often, because that is what we're doing to try to help somebody stay in their home. But landlords may go ahead and pursue, and tenants may pursue a damages phase that we're often not involved in. So,
may I do a follow-up? Clarification?
Follow-up?
Thank you. So was the 3,000 individuals that you represented last year, or was that 5,000 last year?
So last year was 5,000 households.
Okay.
And then the year prior was approximately 3,000 households.
And your estimate was the, Mary, Madam Chair, your estimate for being tenant-landlord issue was 700 of the 5,000 about, or you don't know for sure?
That is a good starting estimate, yes.
Okay. Yeah. That's quite a bit. That's a huge chunk. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, thanks so much for being here. I have used Alaska Legal Services to educate my tenants. I have a lower income district with a lot of renters, and I held a town hall, and I was very appreciative that a lawyer from your organization spoke about landlord-tenant rights. What was interesting to me is that I learned through that town hall that in Alaska, landlord-tenant rights are really landlord rights. And that we are, in my opinion, much more geared towards the landlord. And so, at least from that presentation, it's slightly a different experience than Vice Chair Allard's, because what they were basically telling the tenants was like, you know, if you haven't done this, you're at fault. If you haven't done this, you're at fault. And I felt like that happened repeatedly. So I did have a different experience. One thing I will say that you guys don't do is you don't, as I understand it, is you don't represent people in getting their deposits back. And I'll just say, as a when I was younger and I had a deposit, it was kept by the landlord. I was a clean tenant. I did not trash that apartment. And they kept the entire deposit. And I know that for poor residents, if this happens to them, they need that deposit to get their new place.
Representative Gray, do you have a question for Ms. Hum?
I do not. I do not. It's okay. I'll just wrap it up.
Very quickly.
Right. So in my experience, I feel like I'm thankful for the work that you do. I wish that there was actually more done for renters. Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Hum? Representative Johnson.
And I may be showing my ignorance here, and forgive me in advance, but where does the other 75% go? You're asking for 25. Where does the other 75% go?
Through the chair.
Representative Johnson, we have Nancy Mead from the courts here to more directly answer that question, if you like.
I guess that tells me the answer.
I would like to invite Miss Mead to the table to join us. That way you or Miss Hum are not put on the spot to answer that question.
To whomever may answer this question, Madam Chair.
Thank you for the record. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair to Representative Johnson, all of the filing fees that the court collects, as well as the punitive damages, which are also mentioned in that statute, are deposited directly into the general fund for the legislature to appropriate onward as you all see fit. The court does not keep any filing fees for its ongoing operations. So this bill doesn't affect the court. We put our money into the general fund, and you all decide what happens thereafter. All this bill says is 25% of that would be directed to Alaska Legal Services, but it would not. It has no fiscal impact whatsoever on the court, and we don't keep any of those funds. It only impacts the general fund. Follow up?
Probably a question for another person who may or may not be in the room. Why is there not a fiscal note on what it costs the general fund?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, to my knowledge, there is indeed. So the court submitted a zero fiscal note because it's neither here nor there to us. But the money under this bill, the 10%, or it could be the 25% should you pass it, is goes through the DCCED, who makes the grant pursuant to this legislation. So they do have, to my knowledge, a fiscal note in the amount that it would cost. I provided the numbers of our filing fees collected, which does vary, and you know what that 25% would be as compared to a 10%.
Representative Johnson, we have Sandra Mueller from who's the director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs online to answer questions regarding their fiscal note that does have a dollar figure attached.
Okay, I'm seeing that now, but I went down to the zero.
There have been two fiscal notes submitted, and the one that shows an impact is from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Do you have any questions for Ms. Mueller?
No, clarification. I will ask them. I'll ask them offline.
Any further questions from committee members? Vice Chair Allard.
I'm still hung up a little bit on this tenant-landlord thing. So if the landlord is out money because they have individuals have legal services through you, do you ever reimburse the landlord if it's found in their favor, or they just walk away and lose a lot of money? Because I've been told that there are individuals that just drag it out, and so they have a place to live, and then they do all this negotiating, but the landlord ends up being out thousands and thousands of dollars. And I've always got my security deposit back.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, landlords are permitted to seek attorney's fees against a tenant if they are successful, one. Two, with all the protections under the Landlord-Tenant Act, as far as dragging cases out, there are limitations on how long that can happen. I mean, eviction cases move very quickly. And typically, if something is being just speaking anecdotally here, if something is being dragged out, it is due to the fact that the landlord and the tenant are in active negotiations, and the landlord's kind of a willing participant in those and is wanting to make the tenancy work. So, okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I do have a question for you. Why the jump from 10% to 25%?
Yes. Thank you, Chair, for that question. We, in 1984, as it was stated, we received $1.2 million for a poverty population of 40,000 people. We now have a poverty population three times that, but a dramatically decreased funding from the state. We need that jump to keep pace with both the rising cost of providing these services and the rising demand for our services.
Thank you. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Carpenter.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question of the Director of CCED?
Yes, Ms. Muller, are you available online to take questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, the question is, has the legislature, to the best of your knowledge, appropriated money into this legal services fund from somewhere other than the percentage of money that's from the statute 0917.020J or from the filing fees that were in reference here for the 25% increase?
So through the chair, if I understand, could you repeat the question whether it came from more than just one fund or through this statute? Is that the question?
No, not specifically. So we're, let me see if I can rephrase, Madam Chair.
Representative Carpenter.
We have two sources of, in the statute, legal services fund that establishes the legal services fund. We have two places where money can be appropriated from. One of them is from the authority under AS09.17.020J. And maybe I'm misreading this here, but then there's a 25% or a current 10% of the filing fees received by the Alaska court system. What I'm curious is if this legal services fund if money has been put into that fund from anywhere other than those locations.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any other than those two sources.
Follow up.
That's it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you to Ms. Hum, for Nancy Mead for being available, and Ms. Muller online. We will now set House Bill 161 aside. We have an amendment deadline for Friday, February 9th at 5 p.m. That concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Friday, February 9th at 1:30 p.m. to have its first agenda forthcoming. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect it is 2:20 p.m.